Chapter 51. The metropolis of the South, the approaches to New Orleans were familiar. General aspects were unchanged. When one goes flying through London along a railway propped in the air on tall arches, he may inspect miles of upper bedrooms through the open windows, but the lower half of the houses is under his level and out of sight. Similarly, in High River Stage, in the New Orleans region, the water is up to the top of the enclosing levee rim. The flat country behind it lies low, representing the bottom of a dish, and as the boat swims along, high on the flood, one looks down upon the houses and into the upper windows. There is nothing but that frail breastwork of earth between the people and destruction. The old brick salt warehouses clustered at the upper end of the city looked as they had always looked, warehouses which had had a kind of Aladdin's lamp experience, however, since I had seen them, for when the war broke out the proprietor went to bed one night leaving them packed with thousands of sacks of vulgar salt, worth a couple of dollars a sack, and got up in the morning, and found his mountain of salt turned into a mountain of gold, so to speak, so suddenly and to so dizzy a height that the war news sent up the price of the article. The vast reach of plank wharves remained unchanged, and there were as many ships as ever. But the long array of steamboats had vanished. Not altogether, of course, but not much of it was left. The city itself had not changed to the eye. It had greatly increased in spread and population, but the look of the town was not altered. The dust, waste paper littered, was still deep in the streets. The deep, trough-like gutters alongside the curbstones were still half full of reposeful water with a moldy surface. The sidewalks were still in the sugar and bacon region, encumbered by casks and barrels and hogsheads. The great blocks of austerely plain commercial houses were as moldy looking as ever. Canal Street was finer and more attractive and stirring than formerly, with its drifting crowds of people, its several processions of hurrying streetcars, and, toward evening, its broad second-story verandas crowded with gentlemen and ladies clothed according to the latest mode. Not that there is any architecture in Canal Street. To speak in broad, general terms, there is no architecture in New Orleans, except in the cemeteries. It seems a strange thing to say of a wealthy, far-seeing, and energetic city of a quarter of a million inhabitants, but it is true. There is a huge granite U.S. custom house, costly enough, genuine enough, but as a decoration it is inferior to a gasometer. It looks like a state prison, but it was built before the war. Architecture in America may be said to have been born since the war. New Orleans, I believe, has had the good luck and in a sense the bad luck to have had no great fire in late years. It must be so. If the opposite had been the case, I think one would be able to tell the burnt district by the radical improvement in its architecture over the old forms. One can do this in Boston and Chicago. The burnt district of Boston was commonplace before the fire. But now there is no commercial district in any city in the world that can surpass it or perhaps even rival it in beauty, elegance, and tastefulness. However, New Orleans has begun just this moment, as one may say. When completed, the new Cotton Exchange will be a stately and beautiful building, massive, substantial, full of architectural graces, no shams or false pretenses or uglinesses about it anywhere. To the city, it will be worth many times its cost, for it will breed its species. What has been lacking hitherto was a model to build toward, something to educate eye and taste, a suggester, so to speak. The city is well outfitted with progressive men, thinking, sagacious, long-headed men. The contrast between the spirit of the city and the city's architecture is like the contrast between waking and sleep. Apparently there is a boom in everything but that one dead feature. The water in the gutters used to be stagnant and slimy, and a potent disease breeder. But the gutters are flushed now, two or three times a day, by powerful machinery. In many of the gutters the water never stands still, but has a steady current. Other sanitary improvements have been made. and with such effect that New Orleans claims to be, during the long intervals between the occasional yellow fever assaults, one of the healthiest cities in the Union. There's plenty of ice now for everybody, manufactured in the town. It is a driving place commercially, and has a great river, ocean, and railway business. At the date of our visit, it was the best lighted city in the Union, electrically speaking. The New Orleans electric lights were more numerous than those of New York, and very much better. One at this modified noonday, not only in Canal and some neighboring chief streets, but all along a stretch of 5 miles of river frontage. There are good clubs in the city now, several of them, but recently organized and inviting modern-style pleasure resorts at West End and Spanish Fort. The telephone is everywhere. One of the most notable advances is in journalism. The newspapers, as I remember them, were not a striking feature. Now they are. Money is spent upon them with a free hand. They get the news, let it cost what it may. The editorial work is not hack-grinding, but literature. As an example of New Orleans' journalistic achievement, it may be mentioned that the Times Democrat of August 26, 1882, contained a report of the year's business of the towns of the Mississippi Valley, from New Orleans all the way to St. Paul, 2,000 miles. That issue of the paper consisted of 40 pages, 7 columns to the page, 280 columns in all, 1,500 words to the column, an aggregate of 420,000 words. That is to say, not much short of 3 times as many words as there are in this book. One may with sorrow contrast this with the architecture of New Orleans. I have been speaking of public architecture only. The domestic article in New Orleans is reproachless, notwithstanding it remains as it always was. All the dwellings are of wood in the American part of the town, I mean, and all have a comfortable look. Those in the wealthy quarter are spacious, painted snow white usually, and generally have white verandas, or double verandas, supported by ornamental columns. These mansions stand in the center of large grounds, and rise, garlanded with roses, out of the midst of swelling masses of shining green foliage and many colored blossoms. No houses could well be in better harmony with their surroundings, or more pleasing to the eye, or more home-like and comfortable looking. One even becomes reconciled to the cistern presently. This is a mighty cask, painted green, and sometimes a couple of stories high, which is propped against the house corner on stilts. There is a mansion and brewery suggestion about the combination which seems very incongruous at first. But the people cannot have wells, and so they take rainwater. Neither can they conveniently have cellars, or graves. Footnote: the Israelites are buried in graves by permission, I take it, not requirement, but none else, except the destitute, who are buried at public expense. The graves are but 3 or 4 feet deep. Greater than the town being built upon made ground, so they do without both, and few of the living complain, and none of the others. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.